Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 Dream Beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Coming up on the Mark Divine Show.
If we focus only on performing, our performance suffers. And I think that's what a lot of us are doing in work and life. We're just trying to get things done as best as we know how, trying to minimize mistakes. And that is harming our performance as well as the journey, as well as, you know, how much joy we have throughout the process.
Hi, this is Mark Divine, and this is the Mark Divine Show. Thanks so much for joining me today. Super stoked to have you on the Mark Divine Show. I love to explore what it means to be fearless and super accomplished and unbeatable by speaking to some of the world's most incredibly compassionate, inspirational, and thoughtful leaders. I've talked to folks from all different areas of life, stoic philosophers and psychedelic researchers and entrepreneurs and leaders in performance coaching, such as my guest today, Eduardo Briceño. Eduardo is the author of The Performance Paradox, Turning the Power of Mindset into Action. He's got a TED Talk that's been viewed over 9 million times. He's a global keynote speaker and facilitator. He guides many of the world's leading companies in developing cultures of learning and high performance. Earlier in his career, he's the co-founder and CEO of Mindset Works, where he partnered with Carol Dweck, who pioneered the idea of growth mindset. Previous to that, he was a venture capital investor with the Sprout Group, and he's a Pahara Aspen Fellow, a member of the Aspen Institute's Global Leadership Network, and inductee into the Happiness Hall of Fame. How cool. Before I get into the show, I wanted you to know that I'm opening up slots for our Unbeatable Coach Certification and our Unbeatable Team for 2024. The Unbeatable Team is an amazing year of transformational training. It's where I direct my full attention and time in coaching and training. I don't do it anywhere else. It's here in the Unbeatable Team that I can give my full attention to help those deeply committed to transforming to become uncommon in a world that you know is rapidly collapsing into fear, moral relativism, and mediocrity. We meet virtually every month as a team, come together 4 times during the year for 3 days of powerful in-person training and practice, and I'm here to help you break through any barriers and to crush all of your goals for 2024. So if you're ready to go deep with me and willing to do the work, I can guarantee amazing strides will be made. Go to unbeatableteam.com and unbeatablecoaching.com to learn more about these unbeatable events. Now, back to the show. Eduardo, thanks for joining me on the Mark Divine Show.
Thank you for having me, Mark. Great to be here.
Yeah, no, it's great to meet you too, and good to know you're up the road in sunny San Jose. And were you from, are you transplant from Venezuela, or were you born here in this country?
I was born in Venezuela. I lived my first 16 years of my life there, and I never thought I would leave. So my dad got transferred when I was in high school, and that was unexpected, and it led to a completely different journey than I expected.
You know, Venezuela has gone through some tough times. Now, we have a good friend who was maybe a little older than you, but she left, and then, you know, she said the family that she left back there, like, there's a lot going on, like a lot of strife and political struggle. And
yeah, it's been really hard. More than half of the people that I grew up with are all over the world. And it's been traumatic for some of the people who have been left behind. My parents and sister are still there, but they'll move to the U.S. In the coming years.
Oh, really? Oh, good luck for them. As I mentioned before we started, I'd like to kind of give our listeners just a sense, like, we know you're from Venezuela, but like, what shaped you to become like a mindset expert? What were the influences in your life, you know, mentors or challenging situations? You know, what were the turning points? Like, what's your life like up to now?
Well, I'll try to make it succinct because I've had a lot of twists and turns and I'm doing things that I never thought I would be doing. My mother and father were both very much numbers people. My mom studied mathematics in college and stayed at home with us. My father was a mechanical engineer and started his career in the oil fields in Western Venezuela, where I was born. He worked for over 30 years for the same company, an oil company, and he ended up being the CEO of one of the divisions. What he always taught me was to work hard, like the value of hard work. That was a good lesson that has served me well. But on the other hand, the lesson was more like, you got to grind it out. You know, you got to go to work and do the work that you dislike, you know, because that's what you have to do. And so I didn't have an entrepreneurial bone in my body. I didn't know any entrepreneurs. I didn't think of myself as creative. And I just went to school and I didn't have any real interest. I just applied myself in school. I tried to fit in. There was a lot of pressure to conform to a norm, I felt like. And I was not a happy kid. But I, without any great, better ideas, I just tried to fit in and try to do okay in school. And I really, looking back, I was focused on just performing. You know, I wasn't, when I was going to school, I was just trying to get good grades and then try to get to a good university. And then when I graduated, try to get a good job, which to me was just a high paying job. So I ended up studying chemical engineering and finance, even though I wasn't interested in those things. It's just like, I just thought it would give me a job that was secure. And I ended up working investment banking in New York City and then spending 5 years in venture capital in Silicon Valley. And I was in a place that I never thought I would end up in, Stamp Hill Road and Menlo Park, you know, investing in leading as startups, you know, with like my own office with like a mahogany desk. But one night I was working and I did something I had never done before and I have never done since, which is I was angry and I started taking it out on the keyboard. I started like hitting the keyboard hard, doing my work. And my thumb started hurting. And the pain started kind of moving through my forearm. I didn't think twice about it because I was used to just working through pain. But the pain got worse over the coming days. And I learned that there's this thing called, you know, a repetitive strain injury. And it was getting worse. So I started getting work on ergonomics and using speech recognition. I started going to the doctor. And I thought at the time that the doctors, I thought of them as car mechanics. You know, I abuse my body. I go to the doctor and they fix me. And that's how I saw it. But this became something that was difficult to diagnose. I had to end up doing lots of things from like Eastern and Western medicine and trying spirituality and all kinds of things to try to figure out what was going on with my body. And my body was getting worse. I met people who had the same condition that I did, which is called myofascial pain syndrome, who couldn't use their hands for more than 10 minutes a day. And that freaked me out because, you know, and I was having trouble like opening doors, brushing my teeth, using the computer. The fact that I might lose my ability to use my hands really woke me up to the fact that I didn't feel like I was doing anything useful with my hands. I didn't feel like if I died or if I lost my ability to use my hands, I wasn't making a dent in the world and I was kind of wasting my life. So I had to learn a lot about health and nutrition and how to hold my body, but also search for a purpose. You know, how am I going to be a good steward of my life and how do I want to live so that looking back, you know, 20 years from now, 40 years from now, I'm going to be proud of how I've lived. And so I went to grad school to pivot and to develop a different path. And when I was there, I met a Stanford professor, Carol Dweck. She's a psychologist who coined the term growth mindset. She was looking for somebody with a business background to start an organization with, to put out growth mindset out into the world. At the time, nobody had heard about it. And her book had just come out. And so that started me on this path. Well, that and just learning about her work and how a fixed mindset had gotten in the way of my goals. I had gotten in my own way because of where I had fixed mindsets. That unlocked a lot of growth for me. And I partnered with her to help others and continue to learn along the way.
That's terrific. How was it to start that company and to work with Carol and talk about that work, the work you did at Mindset Works?
It was wonderful. And Carol's been, you know, a close mentor for 16 years now. But Mindset Works, it's an organization that helps schools foster cultures of learning rather than cultures of performance, which is when I was going to school, I was just focused on grades, right? So growth mindset cultures, both for the adults, for the kids, for the parents. And it was an amazing experience doing work that I was passionate about helping, you know, turn around and just foster cultures where kids develop the love of learning, a love of growth, and teachers, you know, develop practices that cultivated that focus on learning rather than focus on just kind of the grades and focus on improving rather than focus on improving, you know, focus on taking on challenges that we can learn from and examining mistakes rather than try to do everything flawlessly. So it was very fulfilling work. I definitely made mistakes. So the company is thriving and it's impacted schools all over the world, but it took us longer than it should have because I made mistakes as a first-time entrepreneur. One of them, I had in venture capital, I felt that there was a lot of pressure to put a lot of money into a company, have it grow quickly and sell it. And I saw this as a life endeavor, as a marathon, and as something that the world wasn't and it wasn't ready for us to like hire a lot of salespeople and marketing and just grow quickly. We bootstrapped the company, and a mistake that I made is that we didn't put enough resources into the company. So we were really focused too much on performance and too little on learning and learning from people who have done it before, and focusing on fewer customers at first to experiment and to figure out what worked best for them. So it was an amazing journey of learning, you know, taking longer than it should have, but amazing growth as well.
Yeah, well, that's a judgment call that, you know, you can make in the rear view mirror.
Yes.
But at the time, it very well was probably the right, you know, the right cost. You know, the pressure, as you know, that you put on an organization when you bring in outside capital and all the different, you know, board kind of vision that gets inserted into it, and suddenly it could have also destroyed the business. Yeah, I struggled with that same thing. I, you know, completely self-funded my organization, and it's taken us a long time. At the same time, we own 100% of it, and we don't have anyone telling us what to do, right? We're not beholden to anybody except our clients. I mean, that could change someday, but it's just the way things were, right?
Yeah, no, and it's a great place to be, you know, where you don't have those outside kind of pressures that sometimes might not be aligned. And on the other hand, you know, there are some great investors there that are long-term investors and focus on the mission and making a good impact. So we also could have searched for those investors that were aligned with us.
Yeah, yeah, no, I hear that. So your interest in performance, you know, I could see started with your own journey of healing. By the way, have you fully recovered from the myofascial issue?
Yeah, I fully recovered. Yeah, it took a long, like I was, for 3 years, I was using speech recognition. For 3 years, I was stretching for an hour and a half every day. You know, I changed the way I eat. I changed the way I exercise. I hold my body. I was psychologically, I was every day telling myself that I was as if I was in a sprint all the time. So I was literally tensing my muscles all the time. And what happened is the muscles are plastic or malleable like the brain is. And so when they were always contracted, they lost the ability to relax. And they became physically shorter. You can measure the range of motion is very restricted. And so they became very hard. And it becomes hard for the blood to penetrate the muscle to then heal the muscle. And so there's lots of things that I had to do. There's something called dry needling, where the needle goes into the trigger point and there's a twitch response, and that creates some. So there's a lot of things that I did. But yeah, at the end, that all worked. And I mean, a much better emotional place, and I mean, with having purpose in the way I'm living, but also such a better healthy place, because I feel like if I had stayed and doing what I was doing, I would probably like have a heart attack, you know, in my 50s, just because I was just doing so many things in an unhealthy way. So at the time, in the middle of it, something that I find interesting is that I thought it was a horrible thing to be for what I was going through in my, you know, mid-20s. But looking back, it was such a blessing that really got me in such a better trajectory.
Right. Yeah. That's always the case, isn't it? I talk a lot about an Unbeatable Mind, which is our training system. And even with SEALFIT, SEALFIT's got more of the harder edge to it, because, you know, training to be a Navy SEAL and training like that, you got to really kind of lean into the hard. But we also emphasize that you have to have equal emphasis, not necessarily equal time spent in the recovery phases in the softer side of training, such as interior skills like you would find in developing mindset, you know, breath control, visualization, positive self-affirmations, those types of things. And with my work with Navy SEAL candidates, you know, that approach, that hard and soft, the yin yang, led to some extraordinary success. Like, you know, the typical Navy SEAL candidate, I think 85% fail SEAL training. And those who trained with SEALFIT, 90% were making it through SEAL training.
Amazing.
It was all mental, emotional, and it was all the soft side, because the hard was well known. You could do Google search, you can go bang out as many miles and as many push-ups as you can, and you can show up pretty good shape. But if you didn't have the softer skills to be able to maintain control and chaos and to be able to become non-reactionary and to be able to relax your muscles so you don't always, you know, suck up all that energy, you know, just by always being in active go mode. So it's extraordinarily important. And I think that's the key to your performance paradox, if I'm not wrong, is like, you got to have the hard balanced with the soft. And then this could be expressed in a lot of different ways, right?
Absolutely. There's definitely a connection there. In the performance paradox, what I realized, so in my work with Carol Dweck, her work on growth mindset, is that she discovered that when we believe that we can change and that our abilities and qualities are malleable, then there's a lot of psychological benefits that come from that. Let's call it growth mindset, versus when we believe that we can't change, that we're fixed in a certain way. Like, for example, you know, people are natural athletes and that's why they're so good, or natural leaders and that's why they're so good, right? Then everybody can become a better athlete or a better leader. So her work has shown that believing that we can change is really important to growth and to performance. But what I also discovered, and what I've learned from her and others, is that we also need to know how to change and how to grow. And that is different from what I thought. So what I had been taught when I grew up is the key is hard work. You know, if you just work hard, you will get better and you will succeed. But what I've learned from Carol Dweck and Anders Ericsson and others is that actually that's misguided, because we can work to perform or we can work to improve. And those are different things. If you think of an athlete, when they're working on the performance, like they're in the match, they're in a tournament, they're in the championship final, they are doing things as best as they know how, trying to minimize mistakes. That's what I call the performance zone. But what we don't see, I mean, you see it because you're behind the scenes, but what most people don't see is that what they do off the court is very different from what we see on the court. Off the court, they might say, this move that I was trying to avoid in the game because I was just failing every time and losing every point, I need to work on that move. I need to work on the next level of challenge that I haven't mastered yet. And that's what I call the learning zone, right? It's leaping into the unknown. And the performance paradox is kind of the counterintuitive reality that if we focus only on performing, our performance suffers. And I think that's what a lot of us are doing in work and life. We're just trying to get things done as best as we know how, trying to minimize mistakes. And that is harming our performance as well as the journey, as well as, you know, how much joy we have throughout the process. And so in the book, The Performance Paradox, what I focus on is in contrasting the performance zone from the learning zone. And what are the different strategies that we use to learn and to grow and improve that are different from just what we do to get the job done? And how can we do both of those things, which are important in our work and in our lives as individuals, teams, and organizations?
Yeah, cool. Overlap, a few things that are coming to me that, you know, I learned in the SEALs and through my many years as a martial artist. Oftentimes, or most of the time, or all the time even, it's really better to do a narrower range of skills and to practice them more than it is to try to master a broader range of skills. And of course, through the, you know, necessity of time, you end up practicing them less. It's like Miyamoto Musashi in Book of the Five Rings said, you know, I'd rather take a warrior beside me who has practiced one sword cut 100,000 times than a warrior who knows 100,000 different sword cuts. And so that kind of, you know, doing less things better, right, is a really powerful principle. And I think you just touched on that. There's also this idea of just doing something you're already good at and just trying to keep on doing it harder. And that doesn't work either, right? Like if you're a runner, just running more miles isn't going to necessarily make you a better runner. There's a whole different attitude about this idea of a learning zone. It's like, you know, even doing different things. You know, my relation to that is like I was a competitive swimmer in Colgate University. And it wasn't until I took up rowing that my swimming improved. Like I literally plateaued for like 2.5 years. And then I took some time, I started a new sport and I came back to swimming and suddenly my everything was so much better by doing something completely different.
Absolutely. Yeah. This Greek orator, for example, is a lawyer named Demosthenes. He was the best orator of his time. But at the time, kind of the courtrooms were outside, they're very crowded and loud, people would shout. And so he did things like go practice by the ocean where it was very loud. He had a twitch in this weird thing he would do with his shoulder. He would bring it up. So he would practice in his basement with a sword hanging from the ceiling so that if he raised his sword, his shoulder, it would hurt. So to your point, yeah, the things that we do to improve are different from just doing more of the activity.
Yeah. I'd love to just get some of kind of like the practical and tactical ideas that you bring forth in the book to unlock the learning zone and to overcome or to live the performance paradox. I'm not sure how you would say that, but, you know, embrace the performance paradox probably better.
So the performance paradox is a challenge. It traps us into chronic performance, into trying to perform all the time. And what we need to think about is first start with, what do I want to improve? What do I want to develop? What do I care about? And just having the consciousness and the intentionality of first, okay, what do I want to get better at? And then what are the habits that are going to help me improve in this area? Do I need a coach? Do I need to do some deliberate practice? Whatever it is, meditation. And so maybe it's, you know, I think that kind of reminding ourselves every morning of what that is that we're trying to improve and how we're going about it is a great way to start. But and then thinking about what are our habits, because a lot of our habits tend to be performance habits, just getting things done, and kind of systems, whether as individuals, teams, or organizations. What are the systems and habits and tools that we're going to use, not just to perform, but also to learn? So for example, in team meetings, so often we talk about just performance things. What do we need to get done by when? You know, how are we going to keep ourselves accountable? That's all really important. We need that. But we could also put into the meeting agenda as like, what have we learned recently that might be helpful to others? Or what questions do we have for each other? Or what insights are we getting from customers? Or what experiments are we running? So that it becomes the easy default, the way we work and live is we work and live in both zones. And what kind of strategies we use varies depending on what skills we want to improve, what our context is, and what, you know, what our resources are.
So when you're coaching, what do you recommend when someone's like beyond the point, they've had the, you know, the go button pressed to full for so long that now they're burned out and they've lost motivation and they, you know, they lack clarity. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen so many people like I have who are just like hit the wall.
Yeah. So, and to your point, in order to be a motivated learner, so I think we need four things. One is the belief that we can change. That's a growth mindset. We need to know how to change. That's founded in the difference between performance and learning. Third, we need a why. We need a reason, a purpose. And you're getting to that. You know, why am I going to put effort into performing or learning or both? And then finally, it's really helpful if we feel like we belong in a learning community, like the people around us are also learners, you know, they're learning alongside us. And we feel like we belong in that community. And so I'm very fortunate that the people who tend to come to me are senior leaders who want to foster a culture of learning in their organizations. So they are motivated because the world is changing faster and faster. They want their organizations to be more agile and more innovative. And so there's interest there. And their challenge is, how do we make this the air that we breathe throughout the organization? And that is something that people embrace. When there's leaders that identify, here are our refreshed core values, here's what we care about, here's how we're going to support this going forward, here's how I'm going to model this, I'm going to be working on it myself, then that is something that people jump to, especially if there's a purpose to the organization, that people feel like their work is important, it's going to make a difference in other people's lives. And so often when that kind of cultural transformation efforts are going on, most people embrace it. Most people, they might have challenges. Like, for example, the biggest challenge is either fear, that fear of how they're perceived if they start talking about what they're learning or the mistakes that they're making, right? So they need to get on the same page, test the waters, make sure people are serious about this. And then the other big challenge is time. You know, people have so much to do in so little time. This is the biggest opportunity, is shifting how we work. For most people, it's not about blocking an hour to work on a very specific skill, although that can be helpful. But it's more, the biggest opportunity is, how do we shift how we do things so that we get things done and improve at the same time? That involves changes, that involves figuring out how to experiment, how to give and receive feedback, for example. And then there's some people who don't take to it right away. It tends to be the minority. What I coach, you know, leaders to do is to invite everybody, but then work with the people who are more ready sooner.
Get the champions on board.
Yeah. Yeah. And then people start seeing that leaders are serious and that this is working and it's leading to success and progress. And then more people kind of join in. And then at the end, there's a few that usually don't make the change and it ends up not being a good fit and they might need to part ways. But organizations can transform their cultures in a really inspiring ways.
Yeah. That's it. In fact, that's a great way to kind of like ferret out individuals who don't have a growth mindset or are incapable of or unready to go there, is to create a growth culture. And then all of a sudden, they, you know, those people start showing up like light bulbs. Okay, we're going to take a short break here from the Mark Divine Show to hear a short message from one of our partners. It's critical that we get great sleep. Yet so many people struggle with it. I used to struggle with it as well. So my go-to is Momenus. Each ingredient in Momenus plays an important role in your sleep. Magnesium L-threonate is a naturally occurring micronutrient that passes through the blood-brain barrier more easily than other forms of magnesium, delivering calm and quiet straight to your brain. Their products are developed with experts like Dr. Andy Huberman and Andy Galpin. Trust is everything when it comes to supplements. I trust Momenus because of their unparalleled commitment to excellence, to rigorous third-party testing, independent certification. Whatever your goal, whatever you want to achieve, you got to get great sleep. Momentus will help you get there. Go to livemomentus.com livemomentous.com. Use the code DIVINE at checkout. That's livemomentous.com. Use the code DIVINE, D-I-V-I-N-E, for 20% off. Hooyah, Momentous. I only promote products that I use, and I like to use products that are very supportive of your health, your fitness, your longevity, those types of things. And sleep is one of the areas that I really am trying to get great information out, because sleep is so critical for your health, for your moods, for your longevity, for everything. And that's why I support Cozy Earth, because I've got some of the most comfortable bedding I've ever experienced. All their products have a 10-year warranty. When I first touched these, I thought I was staying in a 5-star hotel, and it was my own bedroom. So I highly recommend checking out Cozy Earth. They provide an exclusive offer for you. Get up to 35% off site-wide when you use the code DIVINE, that's D-I-V-I-N-E, at their website, CozyEarth.com. CozyEarth.com. Use the code DIVINE. Get 35% off some amazing bedding to help you sleep like a rock star. And now back to the show. This is very inspiring, because we're doing, starting, I should say, to do some similar work with our Unbeatable Mind, primarily through like individual clients who've been working with us who then want to bring us into their teams to help transform their cultures. Probably how, you know, it's worked out with you as well. And so we call it creating a growth culture and vertical development. So my next, I mentioned I'm getting my dissertation done at Pepperdine, and I'm going to be studying vertical development of teams. And so what that essentially is growth, right? The accretion of growth through successive stages of development, of human development, ego development, as opposed to horizontal skill development, which is like accruing new communication skills or strategy, you know, developing, you know, tactics and stuff like that. Both are important, but as you vertically develop individually or as a team, then you're able to see more, take more perspective, include more, you know, have more of these kind of balanced approaches to life that we're talking about here. It's very important work. And the other thing that you said, which I think is really critical, is like in the old model, personal development was kind of like done on your own time. You know, maybe you take a course, or, you know, you do your Coursera stuff, but you really didn't do it at work, you know, like because you didn't have the time, or it wasn't, you know, culturally appropriate. Whereas I think in the new paradigm is like you go to work, and that's your best opportunity to grow. And the company and the leaders recognize that if you have a growth culture, then everybody benefits. All the stakeholders will benefit, and you'll have a much healthier workforce. So you go to work to grow, not just to go to work. So that's a new paradigm. And I'm really, really excited to see that emerge. And we're going to do a little bit of our part. We're just getting busy with that. But it sounds like you've been doing it for some time now.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I do see a lot of organizations shifting, and it's really exciting.
We're influenced by Robert Keegan's work out of Harvard, Deliberately Developmental Organization. And we've kind of like, that's not prescriptive. So our work is more prescriptive in that we deliver the Unbeatable Mind, you know, integrated training system and what we call the Unbeatable Mind operating system to be able to assess both potential and performance, which is kind of the yin yang of the individual, and the potential performance or the yin yang of the collective. So culture, deepening connection, and then the organization itself clarifying and emboldening the vision in service, right? And so when you can work on all these four dimensions simultaneously, right, you have this real acceleration of growth and learning.
How do you decide, Mark, like what you bring into those programs? Because your interests are so varied, and, you know, on a spiritual sense and like on a human sense, I feel like you're such a high level, like that people might not be ready for some of the things that you teach. So how do you decide what you bring and what you kind of leave?
So just like with you, like there's the framework, and then there's the customization for the unique needs of the client, right? So every client's culture, you got to kind of start where they're at, but you can kind of like draw a roadmap. So a lot of and the other thing about our training, Eduardo, is like, I call it taking the foo out of the kung fu. So we have some deeply spiritual practices that people don't even know are spiritual practices, right? So we start each meeting with box breathing. It's a simple practice to calm the nervous. You know, we have all the science behind, like, what is it doing for your arousal control? What's it doing for your attention control? If you practice it over a long period of time, it's going to deepen your powers of concentration, help you focus more, get more done. So, we, you know, very practical. So I teach it to Navy SEAL candidates, but if I told them that I was teaching them a yogic pranayama practice, their eyes would roll back in their head and they'd go to sleep, you know? So we've developed these practices over the years, which are just very simple, very practical, but have a profound impact on your psychology, physiology, sense of self. What's unique about what we're doing is we're doing them as a team. Like we create the safety so that the team is okay to shut their eyes and breathe together. And the team is okay to share vision and to actually visualize, right? Because we know from sports performance, like it's one thing to have a vision, but if you're not practicing every day, you're not adding to that, adding energy to that imagery, that then, right? It's just like shooting one round versus having, you know, full magazine. And so, but most people aren't taught how to do this, and they're awkward if they think they're going to do it in a group. And so we help dispel all that through example, through training, through kind of like walking them along the path. And so it's very cool because we're bringing this vertical development into teams and teaching them these, what I think, and probably you would agree, is like the next frontier in personal and leadership development is all these internal skills that have been ignored in the Western world, you know?
Yeah, and it's so exciting. And as when people go through those experiences together and grow together, it builds their bonds, their trust. They can be more transparent with each other in sharing more of their emotions or their thoughts. And that feeds learning and performance, right? Because we are bringing all of our perceptions and all of our ideas together without fear. And so that's really powerful work.
I'd like to kind of like double click on that. You should talk about like, trust is a big deal right now, you know, especially since COVID and all the political polarization that's going on and working remotely, right? The studies have shown that trust is like degraded by 20-30% just because, you know, we don't really have the opportunity to be in person anymore. So how do we build more trust? What are some of your ideas on how do we really recover trust and build more trust in organizations?
Well, I think we need to be clear on the goals and then give people structures and the clarity of goals to deliver on those goals. Rather than when people are working from home, for example, tracking how much time they're working, for example, that erodes trust, right? Because they're getting the sense that you don't trust them, versus if you get clear on what are the expectations in terms of outcomes. And then, you know, tell me if you need support and, you know, let's see if we are aligned, you know, going in the right direction and meeting the right progress that we want to be meeting. So we want accountability to both performance and to learning, but it is about being clear on the goals and having transparency on ongoing conversations, but not micromanaging, more being more about how can I support you to deliver on these goals, and then for each of us to deliver on those goals, right? And if we get into situations where we are at peril of delivering on something, then bringing that up and saying, hey, like this is not going as planned, or you know, I might need more time on this. It goes through all of us need to take responsibility to just be open with each other about expectations, about what needs to get done, and then deliver or have conversations about, you know, when it's not happening and what we can do about it. What are your ideas?
Well, I like a lot of what you're saying. Like work is different when it's virtual, right? Because you just lack kind of like the hangout time. Like there's a concept called hamago, hang out, mess around, and go deep, right? And those are three ways that we kind of interact in a normal workspace. And so I think if we could bring hamago back into like virtual, where we have some time, right, to just hang out and just not be so performance focused. And then the going deep is learning, maybe like we have some learning time. So I think some companies really get that, some cultures get that, but most when it's like virtual, it's just like you said, it's all do, task, you know, check up on the task and all that. So I think that's what we're trying to do is like build more hamago, more hanging out time. You know, just sharing ideas, don't have to have any specific outcomes. But, you know, sometimes the best idea comes when there's no pressure because we're just sharing stuff like around the water cooler. And then I think what you said earlier, or we talked about earlier, is like being okay to recontextualize productivity. It's like some of the studies coming out about the 4-day work week. So, anyway, you're actually just as productive or more because people are motivated to have that third, you know, that 3-day weekend. It's countercultural for Westerners, right? For me, like I try to prioritize like one main thing every day. And like today and yesterday, I've got some podcasts lined up. So like these podcasts are my main thing. So I won't like schedule a lot of other stuff. I have other meetings, you know, but they're not where my energy is focused. So figuring out like what we call the most important target, what's your most important target for the day? Radically focus on that. and then just relax about the other stuff. Allow for some spontaneity, cancel a meeting if you know it feels like it's going to drain your energy, you know, just, and that's been really helpful because by focusing on that one thing and releasing the pressure on that, just the endless task list, then what happens is things start to solve themselves. And also you have more space to recontextualize. And so what happens is you suddenly see that the way you were looking at a problem that had broken it down into these tasks is wrong. And maybe there's a way to come at it that has way more leverage. So the idea of doing less things better means decluttering your environment, focusing on the right things for the right reasons, and allowing the space for what I call shibumi, that effortless perfection, that just that knowingness that comes can only come from stillness when your mind is out of the way. So I prioritize a lot of meditation and contemplation into my day, not just in the morning, but also in midday and in the evening, you know, transition between work and home. And I can guarantee almost all of my good ideas come from those silent times.
Yeah, that resonates. And to me, it makes me think of, I try to think about kind of the mental and emotional states that I want to have as part of the mix in my life, right? And the habits.
Like a pre-framing them almost.
Yeah, because it's like in a book, I talk about the performance zone and the learning zone, and I contrast those two, but there's other things, right? There is joy and fun and connecting with others and mindfulness and playfulness and rest and mind wandering. So it's that concoction of what are our daily habits and what kind of emotional and mental states do we go through? And all of that together both leads to better performance and a better journey along the way.
We got to wrap up soon here, but anything that we haven't touched upon with your work that you think that the listener would be interested in?
I'll just kind of highlight that when we get unstuck from chronic performance and we add some of these other elements to our life, our performance increases, we achieve higher goals, but the richness of life is so much better. We experience more joy from whether it is exploration and discovery, or we get to know each other better, we listen better, we ask more questions, so we develop better relationships. We also experience less anxiety and depression because, you know, we have tools to deal with a fast changing world and with challenges. We know, like, we're not perfect. We can always kind of learn from. So whenever there's a challenge, we know what to do. We know how to learn from that. And so, you know, a lot of us are stuck in chronic performance and also like in just the biggest challenges of society. I think we're stuck in chronic performance. Often, you know, there's two sides to political sides, and each of them has like is sure of what the solution is, it seems to me often. And what we do is determined by who gets to power. You know, when we get to power, then we say, okay, now we're going to do this, as opposed to here's the hypothesis, let's test a few things, let's talk to people who think differently than me, and let's figure out how to continue to solve this problem better and better over time. So those are kind of some things to think about.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. That whole idea of like transcending your positionality, like as a culture, we've got to be able to transcend the positionality of the left, right, wrong, you know, kind of gridlock to really, I call it post-liberal, post-conservative. People say, what are you? Are you Republican or Democrat? I'm like, I'm neither. Like, I don't identify with any of those. And so where do we go from that? Well, you got to move beyond. And that's what growth mindset is. You got to be willing to go beyond your biases and your positionalities to be open to the fact that there are multiple legitimate viewpoints on everything under the sun, for that matter.
Absolutely. And we learn so much from people who think differently than us, you know, whether it's understanding people's experiences and backgrounds and why they think the way they think. And we gain so much insight from listening to, you know, people's perspectives. So I've been always independent just because I don't want to put a hat on my head that makes me more biased.
Yeah.
Because I want to be on this team or another team. And that's important to me as well.
So your book is out, The Performance Paradox, Turning the Power of Mindset into Action, came out September. Where can folks kind of like connect with you, learn more about your work besides the book?
I am active on LinkedIn and my website is briseño.com. I have a monthly newsletter and some resources there to develop a growth mindset.
Well, Eduardo, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a brilliant conversation. I really love the work you're doing and wish you great luck with it. And maybe we'll connect and find some way to work together someday. That'd be fun.
Ditto. It's great to speak with you, Mark. I love your work. And thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, it's been my honor. All right. Take care.
You too.
What a great interview with Eduardo. Thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed learning your views on the performance paradox. We share a lot of great ideas, and I appreciate your work, Eduardo. And thanks to my incredible team for bringing guests like Eduardo to us every week. That's Catherine Devine, Jeff Haskell, and Jason Sanderson. You can find the show notes up on my markdevine.com website. You can find YouTube on the YouTube channel. If you want to reach out to us with ideas or questions, you can find me at Twitter X, at Mark Devine, and on Instagram and Facebook at Real Mark Devine, or on my LinkedIn. If you're not getting my newsletter every Tuesday morning, then go to markdevine.com to subscribe for the Devine Inspiration Newsletter, where I disseminate my most top-of-mind inspirational things that are happening, people, habits, etc. I also have a blog and the notes for the weekly podcast. Go check it out. It's really positive and helpful. Finally, please rate or review the show if you have the time or if you are so inclined. It's very helpful to keep the show at the top of the ratings and for other people to find it and share it with your friends. Thank you so much for doing the work and for being part of the positive change that we want to see in the world. It has to start with us. We have to, like Gandhi said, be the change we want to see in the world, but we can now do it at scale because of technologies like this show and the books and newsletter and collaboration. So thanks for being part of that journey, and we'll see you next time. Until then, be unbeatable. Yeah.